Its coverage of politics and the arts, but for much of its history, the magazine has devoted quite a few pages to the greatest players and moments in professional sports. A new book, edited by David Remnick, The Only Game in Town, Sports Writing from the New Yorker, compiles some of the magazine's most memorable profiles, ranging from Michael Jordan and knuckleballer Tim Wakefield to boxer Mitt Wilson Meisner. Last July, David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, and Roger Angel, a longtime star writer for the magazine, came by to discuss the book and recent news in sports. Listeners told us how much they enjoyed the conversation, so we're airing it again during this Labor Day holiday show. I began by asking Roger, this book is dedicated to you, so you must have been writing for The New Yorker for a long time.
I think that's why. I think it was I was the oldest sports writer he could think of.
Oh, posh.
When did you begin?
As a sports writer.
Oh, just as a writer.
As a writer, my first piece in the New Yorker was I was in the Army, and I think it was in February of 1944.
Mm-hmm. But then you joined in 56?
I came on as an editor in 56, yes.
And you have worked as a chief fiction editor, or you've written fiction, nonfiction. Criticism. You used to write an annual Christmas poem for the magazine.
I still do.
When did you begin writing about sports?
In 62. Actually, I'd written before that. I'd written some sporting scene pieces about hockey and football and stuff like that. But in 62, Bill Shawn, the editor, came and said we needed more sports. And he knew I was a baseball fan. And he told me to go to spring training and see if I could think of something to say. And I've been sort of doing it ever since.
Didn't you also write about sports when you were at the Washington Post?
I was. I was a sports writer for a couple of years at the sports section of the Post. And the first time I met Roger was when I was an intern reporter at the Post. And Roger had just published a book called Late Innings. Mm-hmm. And I had read him a lot and loved his work.
We both looked exactly the same.
We looked exactly the same, and I was in short pants. And I was told to meet him at this very dark Italian restaurant outside of a radio or a television station in suburban D.C. And he came in, and we couldn't find each other for a while. And the next thing you know, he was showing me on this table with sugar packets and salt shakers and pepper shakers how Fenway Park is arranged and all the angles of the outfield wall. And so I thought, I'm never going to be this good, and I'm certainly not going to have this grasp of the detail of the complexity of baseball. But you know, Roger really remains the great baseball writer of our time and earlier times too.
And one critic has said that one of Roger's pieces, "Gone for Good," about the career of Steve Blass, may be the best piece that anyone has ever written on baseball or any other sport. So that's high praise, isn't it?
I think of Roger first and foremost as a writer who decided to take baseball up as a way of writing and as a way of looking at so many things without getting too fancy about it. And one of the extraordinary things is the ability to throw a voice that if you look at these early pieces in the Summer Game, what you have is a writer that invents a voice and a kind of character that is himself. That I have to tell you, the Roger that I first knew and know now, I've known him for many years, that voice is not always in evidence. It's something that you have to work very, very hard. People think that the idea of a writer finding his voice or her voice, that great cliche of the classroom, is something that's kind of easily done. I think that it's a real literary achievement.
But haven't some of the finest stylists written about sports? Why do you think that is? Ring Lardner, Red Smith.
Somebody once said that the smaller the ball, the better the writing, because it starts with golf, which is the smallest ball, I guess, used. And there's been a lot of terrific golf writing, and we have some in this book by Herbert Warren Wind. The great thing about writing about baseball, I think, is there's so much time to wait and to watch. There's a whole lot of waiting in baseball, and there's ball one, ball two, strike one, and and you look around and you can look at the batters and you can think about the game and you can take notes and you can reflect on what you can sort of think, and you can now and then a real thought descends and you can take a note and write it down. When I began writing about baseball, I would travel around to the parks, and I was afraid to talk to the ball players. I didn't know them, so I basically wrote about myself because I was a fan, and I wrote as a fan in my pieces. I had a lot of room in the magazine and a lot of time to write the pieces, and there's a sense of space, I think, that went around those, and I said I'm a Red Sox fan or I'm a Mets fan and put that into it, which hadn't been done before. And the other thing I did at first was to write about the crowd, which has always been, before that, had been the omitted item. I think nobody had mentioned the crowd much, although we had 40 or 50,000 or 1,200 fans, depending on the
And
on
much
the
of
game.
Your experience of a game is involves the fans, people around
what the fans
you.
Are doing. And so I could say we, because I was I was doing the same thing, sitting with them and watching and having the game bore me or excite me or involve me. And I could also say I, so this is, I think, this voice. I didn't try to find a voice, but it seemed a good fit, and I had some good samples, too. One of the pieces in this wonderful collection is John Updike's famous piece, Hub Fans Bid Kid Adieu, which was written 3 or 4 years before I began to write about baseball. And it's a piece about Ted Williams' last game ever played, and it was idle late summer, late September game. The Red Sox weren't going anywhere. John Updike wasn't going anywhere. Actually, as he later wrote in an introduction to a later edition, he had a date with a young lady that, or a young, I don't know if she's young or not, but he had a liaison meeting, a rendezvous, and he got stood up, and he said, "What am I going to do?" And he said, "She's not in." And he went to the ball game instead. And you could just walk up. This is the last Ted Williams, last game ever. But you'd walk up and buy a ticket. And he walked in and sat down and watched Ted Williams hit a home run in his last at-bat and wrote one of the great sports pieces ever written. And for me, I think that the tone that we're talking about and my way of writing about baseball was invented by John Updike, because it's all in that piece. It really is. It's John writing about himself. He is involved with the crowd, and he's watching every single thing that goes on, the crowd and the atmosphere and the ball player and what he thinks all flow into this narrative. A beautiful piece of writing.
My guests are Roger Angel of The New Yorker and of any number of best-selling books on sports, mostly baseball, David Remnick, who's the editor of The New Yorker and editor of a new book called The Only Game in Town, Sports Writing from The New Yorker. It's published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. David, how does a New Yorker sports piece differ from, say, a piece in Sports Illustrated or in the Daily News?
Well, we don't cover sports in the sense that we're not responsible for daily coverage. We just dip in when there's something that we find interesting. And sports writing, I should say, and I think Roger would second me on this, in many regards has gotten harder than it was. It's gotten harder because the ballplayers make so much money that they don't need you, or if they're going to give access to themselves, it's going to be of a very limited sort. There's that wonderful scene in the movie Bull Durham where the ballplayers on the bus, even these minor leaguers, practice their cliches in order to deflect having to talk honestly or openly as they would maybe here. And what Roger brings to it, and any writer that even approaches him writing about sports, is the capacity to ignore that problem or to get around that problem by bringing his or her own literary powers to bear. There aren't many people that can do that. Somebody that could do it, another person in this book, is A.J. Liebling. A.J. Liebling wrote about boxing for the New Yorker in mid-century. Just fantastically funny. And his way of doing it, he did talk to the fighters, but I think, quite frankly, he heightened some of those voices in a way that we wouldn't do now. But another way is that he invented this literary voice of his own that was a kind of high-low move. In other words, somebody who he's completely intimate with the rhythms of 18th century English prose, Cobbett, and lots of writers like that, 18th and 19th century English prose. And so he had this kind of high style married to a low subject, and that's where the comedy comes in. And it's full of belly laughs and drama. And also, but he existed at a time when those athletes, fighters, spoke with him for hours and hours, would have dinner with him, they'd take trips together. He knew them in a way that's very, very difficult to do now because of money mainly.
Well, one of the things that you have here that we wouldn't get from the Daily News is you get writers who we don't normally associate with sports writing to write about sports. You mentioned John Updike. You also have Don DeLillo. You have John Cheever. You have Lillian Ross writing about bullfighting.
Those ink-stained wretches. Oh, those people are not
Martin
people
Amos.
Who are going to do daily coverage. It takes different kinds of muscles. I have all the respect in the world for it. But it's a very different set of muscles.
And did they give something quite different when Martin Amos writes about tennis?
Martin Amos, do you worry that
he knows a lot about tennis?
He knows enough. And I think he may not be the most knowledgeable tennis writer in the history of, one of the tennis magazines, but he certainly knows enough. And the piece that he's got in the magazine is actually is a comic piece about ego and personality. It's too dirty to describe in detail here, but it's a comic piece. Mm-hmm. John McPhee may not be the most knowledgeable. Bill Simmons may know a hell of a lot more about professional basketball and college basketball than John McPhee, but John McPhee's piece on Bill Bradley as a college player, Bill Bradley's one of the great college players of all time, called A Sense of Where You Are, is just an exquisite piece of writing that gets inside both the game of basketball, which people had mocked, as Red Smith used to call it, the up-and-down game. He wasn't very enthusiastic about it. And McPhee got inside this game and inside this very young guy who we now think of as, a mature statesman and so on, now retired, in a way that would be very, very hard to do now.
That McPhee piece, everybody should read it. It's a great piece. It was his first McPhee piece for the magazine.
Before he started writing about food and others.
He'd been at Time magazine before.
And it if you read that, you can see everything that McPhee is in that piece. He didn't have to become something. In that piece, he is complete. The endless research, the very careful analysis and watching of what's going on. But best of all, a subject who is completely unlike anybody else who's ever played basketball. Bradley was an intellectual and a great scholar and became a scholar of his game while he was becoming one of the great practitioners of the game. And McPhee, and this piece goes on, and there's actually very precise descriptions of the movements of basketball because Bradley had this all in his head. He knew where the players were going to be, and he could tell you why a player in a certain moment was going to be in a certain place on the
McPhee
court.
McPhee even goes to get Bradley's peripheral vision tested. He
takes him
to an ophthalmologist.
That's right.
And he discovers that Bradley's peripheral vision, which is so important, you see it in any great point guard in the NBA, has unbelievable capacity to see the game. It's a very important quality for a quarterback.
Although Bradley was a shooting guard.
Bradley was a small forward.
Oh, small forward.
But he had incredible peripheral vision, and it was a great passer. And that was, of course, the trademark of the Knicks in the late 60s and early 70s. And he gets this examined and discovers that Bradley has, in fact, extraordinary peripheral vision.
It is interesting.
Gretzky could do this with hockey, which is harder because it's faster moving. Yeah. But Gretzky knew where every single player was at every moment in a hockey game, apparently.
But it's interesting that the focus is on him as a college player because the opening essay is on the 1981 Yale versus St. John's baseball game. And that one features two college stars who went on to become stars in Major League Baseball as well.
That was my luckiest day in a ballpark. This was a college playoff game, a preliminary to the NCAA, the finals out in Omaha, played at Yale. And Ron Darling's pitching for Yale, and
Frank Viola
was the St. John's pitcher. And
they wound up being teammates eventually.
They wound up
with
teammates, and I went with I did arrange this. I went with 91-year-old Smokey Joe Wood, who had been the Yale coach for 24 years, and before that, one of the great, great pitchers in baseball, and one of the great strikeout artists. It won 34 games of the season of 1912, and then went on to win three more in the World Series. So he is sitting beside me at Yale Field, and what we see, as he says at the end, is the greatest college game he ever saw. And I went home that night, and I thought, I think I got something to write today.
Well, you're going to be 90 in September, so I'm going to say happy birthday now. But can you still say this was the greatest game I ever saw, or the greatest sports event I ever experienced?
I try not to, because I don't go there.
There must have been a lot of different things that you saw.
Well, there've been a lot of games that you suddenly think this is sort of a game. In the sixth game of the 1975 World Series, Pete Rose comes up late in this game, which has had some astounding developments, and later was called by everybody the greatest baseball game ever played. I was there, and Pete Rose comes up to bat and turns to Carlton Fisk and says, "This is some kind of game, isn't it?" I mean, for he himself, they realize that what's going on here.
I say Roger comes into the office after a World Cup game, after a professional football game, after a World Series game, that it's as full of enthusiasm for what happened the night before as any 18-year-old or kid in my home.
Or rage.
I remember in the final game of this last Subway Series, I had the privilege of going with Roger, Yankees-Mets, and we're sitting in the boonies. We were not in the press box. We were in the upper deck in the left field stands. And I turned to Roger.
Did you choose to be there?
I couldn't have chosen anywhere better to be on earth than with Roger at this World Series game. And I said, "What's the first World Series game you ever saw?" And I think it was the passed ball game of Mickey Owens.
It wasn't one of the first, but I did see the passed ball, the 1941 passed ball game. But what happened in the game that David is talking about is that I was writing a book about David Cohn, who was pitching with the Yankees, and David Cohn had a terrible year and had a severe injury and had been kept on basically because Joe Torre loved him so much and had said he would be available for relief pitching during this late game against the Mets. And suddenly in the fourth inning, I realized that David Cohn is warming up already because Torre has it in mind that he wants him to pitch to Mike Piazza. At this point, I leave David and I start running from deep left field around the circle, the perimeter of Shea Stadium, and I arrive on the dead run. So I'm behind home plate in the main press box, and all the New York press box regulars, the New York writers, start falling down laughing because they know I want to see what David's going to do. And he pitches to one batter and throws a terrible pitch, a pitch that Piazza could have killed. And pops him up, and that's the end of David's career with the Yankees.
But there was also a psychological aspect to that because David Cohn had been a star with the Mets earlier and left the Mets. And psychology is a major part of many of these stories. We have to take a little break when we come back, David. I want you to tell the story about going to cover the Mike Tyson Evander Holyfield fight in Las Vegas. Talk about psychodrama. My guests are Roger Angel and David Remnick. We're talking about a book called The Only Game in Town, sports writing from The New Yorker, which is published by Random House. Back with an interview I did in July with David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, and the editor of a new book called The Only Game in Town, sports writing from The New Yorker, which is published by Random House. He was here along with Roger Angel, one of the writers who's represented in the book as well. He should be, because he's one of the great writers on sports of all time. Before I brought up the Tyson-Holyfield boxing match, I asked, in going over all of the sports writing The New Yorker has published, did you notice any changes in the approach over the years or in sports writing in general?
There's not a hell of a lot of it in volume. There are writers like Roger, like A.J. Liebling, like Herbert Warren Wind, who stuck with it. But that's the exception. I think The New Yorker, by my lights, could use a little more sports. And I think you'll see, I hope, more of it to come because it's such an incredibly complex, fun, and telling American spectacle and world spectacle, and we need more of it, and it takes it's almost easier to assign reflexively pieces about politics than it is about sports.
Well, there's always this temptation to see sports as a metaphor for something else. And you're shaking your head, Roger. You don't like that kind of writing.
I tried never to do that.
That's
I don't
right.
think this is what America is about or what the world is like. Or
That can get awfully gooey, the stuff about baseball being about coming home and the pastoral America of the night. It can get a little gooey.
My favorite was years ago, somebody proposed that it was really a Freudian setup and that the mother was throwing the pitch to the father and the son was trying to intercept it.
But what I did,
you know,
it was an Oedipal thing.
Letter, that's absolutely new. I've never heard that before. Thank
God knows.
Oh, loved it. I've remembered it all my life.
And what would a passed ball mean in that? I don't even want to think about
silent.
It.
Wild
pitch.
I don't want to think about it. I fall silent before that thought. What I do think happens is that I think that every kid who gets every 12-year-old to 17-year-old who gets involved with baseball begins to think about life and death because he watches a young player. His eye falls on, becomes a hero of his, and over a period of the next 6 or 7 years, he watched that player go into middle age, and then by eight or nine years, and approach death and die and leave. And he doesn't think of the metaphor in those quite as clearly as that, but that's what's happening. It's the first lesson.
Well, how do you write about something like that Yale St. John's game and make it interesting and approachable to people who don't know much about baseball?
Well, I told some personal stories. I told about my father had seen the 1912 World Series because he was a law student at Harvard. My mother lived in Boston and was a baseball fan as a young woman there. And when my father and mother got married, they moved to Cleveland, where my father was beginning to practice law. The same year that Tris Speaker got traded from the Red Sox to the Indians, and my mother once said to me, Tris Speaker and I got traded to Cleveland in the same year, which was true.
And now LeBron has left, and we have
Cleveland, and I know a very a young, really, really serious Indians fan, now 12 years old or about that, and I think about him always. A summer friend of mine who won a baseball bet from me about 2 years ago, one penny.
A lot of these stories cover moments in sport that we do know well, where there's no surprise at the outcome of the race or the match. What do those stories tell us?
Well, I think some of these stories are designed to tell us more profound things. Adam Gopnik has a wonderful personal piece in here. I'm loath to pick one or two out because I'll get accused of favoritism, but Adam's piece is about kids' football. It's about a mini football league played out in, I think, Central Park. And the coach of his son's team is dying. And it is inevitable, if you care about sports, that these events get attached somehow. They become markers in your life. They become more important than you ever thought they would be. I'm proud to say, I've never revealed this secret, and I'll do it now, that one of my proudest moments as a parent is one of my sons makes an appearance in a Roger Angel story. It was one of the great nights in my family's life. We somehow got tickets to see a playoff game, the playoff game against the Red Sox and the Yankees, if you're a Yankees fan. And the Yankees were getting killed through the game. And my son, my middle child, who is Noah, is a baseball maniac, as is my wife. And he was so upset by the course of this game that he sat on the concrete and didn't want to watch what was going on in the field. He just couldn't bear it. He had already seen enough losing when the Diamondbacks had beaten the Yankees. He had grown up thinking the Yankees win every year. And the Yankees started to come back, and of course Aaron Boone hit a game-ending seventh game home run, and he makes this very slight, unnamed appearance in the Roger piece. But I'll never forget that night for the rest of my life, not because of the baseball game, because I've seen lots of great events on television or otherwise, but because it's attached to that interplay, to see your son so unalloyedly happy. To feel that yourself, it doesn't happen very often in life, and especially the game's also teach you even more importantly a little bit about losing. It may not be a metaphor, but it is something. It is something that you feel and you remember.
Can I go on about that same game? Mm-hmm. I was at that game, and about a week later, I got a letter from a fan, a reader. I guess it was about a month later, and who said he'd been sitting in deep left field, and he caught the Aaron Boone home run, and he said there'd been a prior home run, a Red Sox home run, that had landed across the aisle from him, caught by a colleague of his at Columbia. And he went on about this ball, and he said that he had the ball in his possession. I looked at the address, and this he was writing to me from where he lived, which is across the street from where I live and about halfway up the next block. So at this moment, I was closer to the ball than I had been when I went out in left field at Yankee Stadium. Only in baseball did that happen.
You would talk about winning and losing, some people, I've always heard that boxers, especially heavyweights, were the great gentlemen of sport. But when I think of Mike Tyson,
Mike Tyson, who increasingly is a self-aware character, and in a tragic sense, I think he's some combination of somebody in a Dostoevsky or Richard Wright novel.
Although
I
mean, he's put tattoos on his face.
Well, it goes deeper than that. He is always, you have to think about the way he grew up, which was, in Brownsville and in the worst circumstances. And he was a bad kid. He was a terrible kid. And he knows this a bit. There's a sense of self-loathing in this guy that is so on the surface. You mentioned the Holyfield fight in Las Vegas. My predecessor as the editor, Tina Brown, cared about sports not a whit. And a good editor really is going to follow his or her passions, and sports just was not one of them, and she was honest about it. And I somehow cajoled her into letting me cover this fight, and her response was, "If you must." And I was sitting ringside and started to see that Tyson was biting Holyfield's ear off, gnawing at it. Mm-hmm. And it was very evident if you were that close. And all the sports writers around me were absolutely horrified. Their moral umbrage was through the roof, as if the sainted name of prize fighting was somehow being besmirched, which is very, very hard to do.
Considering the fact that part of the goal is to cause damage to the other person.
Is to inflict temporary brain damage in the person, and it's a sport run largely by the mob until it became largely run by Don King. and yet it has its very, very guilty pleasures. But I have to say I was thrilled because I knew I had a story. And that's a kind of writers are like that. There's a certain kind of differentness in a writer that when you see that there's a story as opposed to kind of a dull boxing match. I knew there was something there to write about.
Didn't you also meet a couple at the fight who were shocked to learn that a New Yorker writer was covering something as vulgar as boxing?
I was sitting having lunch at a casino, and I had on the – I was wearing around my neck the credentials that you're made to wear, and they're the size of a dessert plate. And they said, "Who are you covering the fight from?" And I said, "The New Yorker." And she said, "The New Yorker would never stoop to covering something like this." And I just thought that was fake New York. I think they were playing blackjack, and it was like fake New Yorker snootiness at its height, not knowing that probably one of the great writers of nonfiction at the New Yorker had been, among other things, a boxing writer.
Now, we're having a pretty
not
eventful...
Not me, by the way, Edgy Lee.
No, you made that
point. With you.
We're having a pretty eventful summer in sports, the World Cup, a record-length tennis match, although some people are saying it was kind of stupid, the death of George Steinbrenner. In the end, what do you think are going to be the great stories of this summer?
I don't think...
Thierry Henry coming to the Red Bulls?
No. I don't think so. I mean, the great thing about sports is that you think you know what the great story is going to be, and then it turns out not to be that at all. The surprises of sport are almost absolute, although this maybe doesn't apply to tennis or something like that. Tennis, I think there's a more consistent winners in tennis than any other sport.
Now, what about the death of George Steinbrenner? Much of the writing afterward was he good for the team? Was he bad for the team? I was surprised that so little mention was made of his non-baseball career, the fact that he was convicted of slipping illegal campaign contributions to Richard Nixon and then pardoned by Ronald Reagan. Do sports supersede politics in a case like that?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think that was quickly forgotten. And his involvement with the Yankees was so intense and went on for so long, it became the main story. The thing about George was that I always thought, looking at his face, It always made me laugh a little bit because his that jaw was stuck out and his arms were folded while he was sticking his chin out at you. But what he was doing was saying that I know what the odds are in any sport. I know about losing, but I'm not going to pay any attention to that at all. And he really did. I mean, he really went the whole way and said, he did not want the games to be played. That's the thing about George. He would load up his team and put the team on the field, but he didn't want the game to be played because all he wanted to do was win. He didn't want to play, and he was not involved in what happened with the game unless the Yankees won.
I'm really ambivalent about him, too. I mean, I think you can't overlook precisely what you're talking about, his not just his political activities, but just the kind of imagery that he brought to the Yankees, the firing five times, the symbiosis with a bad guy like Billy Martin. I don't think, that it was overlooked. I think there was a tsunami of coverage, and some people wrote about one thing and some people wrote about the other. I was raised on the Yankees, loved them, and when I was growing up, they were awful. They were awful. And so you can't – the great ambiguity of it is that he clearly made them a much better team. Of course he did.
Well, we mentioning politics. Politics has come up during the World Cup. In fact, you had a little piece on how the World Cup became politicized in an American talk radio, didn't it? Or with the American conservatives claiming that
Rick
it was socialist.
Rick Hertzberg wrote about the ridiculousness of some of the commentators on Fox somehow comparing where people on Fox find socialism is under every bed, and sometimes it's
you have
under,
a cartoon some, to that effect.
That's
in the
right. It's either Barack Obama's bed or under the bed of every World Cup team. It's preposterous. I do think going back to baseball though, and I watched the World Cup like crazy, and I enjoyed it.
And the ratings were incredibly high.
They were and
higher than the All-Star.
But they
game.
Won't be for the Red Bulls. Mark my words. If all these sports that I've ever seen, the one that's the perfect game in terms of its rules, to me, there's no question that it's baseball. And at the same time, its fan base is not getting any younger. I think part of it's the length of the games, which exacerbate the image of it being a dull game. And I think that's too bad.
I think the other part is that baseball is, like all sports, is available all the time, right around the clock. You can watch – you know what happens – if you're stay at home, you can see the result of every game. You can see every highlight. You can see every home run. You can see every great play in the course of an evening. So the reporting side of baseball has disappeared, and the writers are left with feature stories. It's one endless feature story or a statistical story. I think one of the reasons that talk radio or talk television about sports is so angry now is that everybody knows this, and there's nothing left to be expert about, except if you're a super expert about statistics, if you become a stats freak, and then you can talk about that.
I want to thank the two of you for being with us today, Roger Angel and David Remnick, the editor of a book called The Only Game in Town, sports writing from The New Yorker. It's published by Random House. It's been a real pleasure talking with both of you.
Thank
again.
You.
Thank you. Thank you, Leonard.